wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. This is KBOO Portland, Portland listener-supported and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg produced today's program. In recognition of National Homeless Persons Memorial Day, today on our program, Desiree Helliger speaks with Catlin Day and Benjamin Donlin from the Western Regional Advocacy Project, or RAP. Immediately following, Chelsea Ratzliff talks with Raven Drake of Street Roots about C3PO, creating conscious communities with people outside. They will be discussing the ongoing tragedy of the homeless, or as many prefer, the houseless. Concluding our program today, as well as concluding our programming for the year 2020, we end with a commentary from the archive by fellow Old Mole Clayton Morgridge, who passed away in January. Bill Resnick kicks off today's program with Nadine Hubbs, historian, musicologist, and cultural critic at the University of Michigan. Hubbs' book, Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music, examines the progressive current in country music. Coming from a working union family, she came to critique the prevalent portraits of working people as racist, misogynist, anti-gay, narrow-minded, and Trump voters. Bill and Dean Hubbs discuss how that portrait is dead wrong, but informs political analysis. They discuss the 2020 election and who actually voted for Biden and Trump. Bill?
Hi, Dean Hubbs. Welcome again to KBOO.
Hi, Bill. I'm so happy to be back.
Dean Hubbs is a historian, musicologist, a cultural critic, works, actually professes at the University of Michigan. Dean's book, Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music, examined the progressive currents in country music. In it, she critiques the prevalent portraits of working people in this country as somehow deficient, racist, misogynist, anti-gay, narrow-minded, bigoted, the deplorables, as Hillary Clinton called Trump supporters. That deficiency portrait is in sharp contrast to how a big majority of social and political critics describe their own stratum, who they see as tolerant, thoughtful, enlightening, fighting racism, accepting multiple sexualities. And in general, they see themselves made of better stuff, and thus, of course, deserving their privilege and higher incomes and domination of the decision-making. Dean Hubbs is one of those too few academics who try to dispel both of those portraits, both quite wrong, but they persist, because these are dominant stereotypes expressed in near all areas of U.S. life and the way working people are treated and not treated, and hospitals and schools and real estate offices. And it's in America's fiction and many fictions. And these stereotypes and images are particularly on display in writing and reports of those who analyze politics, particularly their analyses of who voted for Trump. In this interview, we discussed the 2020 election and who actually voted for Trump. And then we discussed Dean Hubbs' studies of country music that challenged the deficiency portrait of working people, and particularly, of course, the content of country music. First, though, Dean Hubbs, tell us about your journey, how you went from making music to studying popular musical culture, particularly country music, your studies that challenged the deficiency portrait.
Well, first, Bill, thank you for that introduction. I love how you put all that, and I really agree with your perspective on how the working class is positioned in relation to what I call, in my book, Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music, the narrating class. So if I talk about my journey, it is a journey from the working class in what is now the Rust Belt. I grew up in the industrial north of Ohio around Lake Erie. My dad worked on the railroad. My mom's twin sister and her husband, they owned a tavern in a tiny farm town in Ohio, population 300, and they had just the greatest jukebox that was majority country, and it was golden age country, so that was part of my musical education. I was a musician. I went to college as a first-gen student. I wound up going on and became a musicologist, and that took me to University of Michigan for my PhD. I was 25 by the time I came to this elite upper middle class bastion, and it totally freaked me out. I had never been around people like this or in this kind of context, and so it was a trial by fire. Fortunately, after that really alienating experience, my first job as a professor was in Detroit at Wayne State University, which got me back with a bunch of first-gen students, largely working class. Then I wound up getting a job back here at University of Michigan, and I do teach a lot of elite students. It's great because I get to teach elite students and a lot of poor and working class students nowadays on topics of class and inequality. So that allows me to meet a lot of the working class students we have at Michigan and to see how eager more privileged students are to learn about class worlds that they don't know.
Dean Hobbs, the elite disparagement of working people seems to me pervades academic study, especially in the very loose way our pundits blame working people for the rise of Trump. They mostly contend it was the working class who supported Trump and gave us Trumpism. I know both of us have been examining essays by Kim Moody and Mike Davis that tell a very different story about the rise of Trump. What do you see as important in their analysis?
First of all, I really appreciate you emphasizing this topic. It's so important, and I feel like we're swimming upstream in trying to talk about it. I wrote about it in Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music. It's so lazy and damaging that the media keeps telling the same old story. And yes, these articles by Mike Davis and by Kim Moody, they give us stats and facts that tell a very different story. First of all, I think it's important to say that Trump's victory was disproportionately from the middle class and upper income voters. Another thing that's really important to point out is the so-called working class voter needs to be defined more clearly and carefully, or we're always going to be trapped in this mythology. We hear that these are people without college degrees. Well, that's 70% of all Americans. Only 30% of Americans have a degree. And not all of that 70% of undegreed Americans is, in fact, working class. Upper income groups are overrepresented among voters, and they disproportionately elected Trump. There were some swing voters, the white working class voters in 2016, but that group that swung from Obama to Trump was significantly smaller than the drop in the number of people who voted from this sector. So more of them simply stayed home and didn't vote than swung from Obama to Trump. Why then do we keep getting this mythology? Well, I trace it back to earlier elections. It's been going on for decades. Through many election cycles that we get this story that was particularly crystallized and weaponized and profitized in 2004 with Tom Frank's best-selling book, What's the Matter with Kansas? He didn't invent the story, but he told a story that a lot of middle-class readers really embraced, and he told it in a winning way that sounded authoritative. It didn't bring data to bear so much as it brought anecdotes to bear. And the story is, back in the good old days, we had a respectable working class, and they knew which side their bread was buttered on. They voted Democrat. After Reagan, more and more working class voters voted Republican, and they did so because white working class voters supposedly switched over to vote Republican because they love their guns, they hate the gays, they hate people of color, and they hate abortion. They do it to their own detriment because the Republicans' policies, their economic policies, hurt these white working class voters more than anyone else. So these people are so dumb and also so hateful that they vote against their own best interests. That book came out in 2004. The story had already been around a while, and the story is still with us.
I have a critique of that book, actually. I think he overemphasizes those cultural issues at the expense of the economic issues. Kansas used to be the aviation capital of the world. It deindustrialized Topeka and Wichita. All of the parts plants in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, they began leaving. And when they left, of course, there's a crisis. My reading of Kansas is a Rust Belt center surrounded by all these rural agricultural areas that are very conservative and also depopulating. And the working class of Wichita and Topeka, many of them still there, they were angry at the Democrats for their trade stuff. I agree that the cultural issues were important, but I think the economic issues were ignored by Frank, that it was the failure of the Democrats to maintain New Deal politics. Instead of protecting the working class, they moved towards this politics of supposed enrichment of everybody through giving capitalists full freedoms, which was destroying the working class.
I agree with that. Being a scholar of culture, I focused in Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music on cultural issues in relation to class. And I have to say that I don't think the narrating class is equipped to tell us, to report to us, in fact, what the cultural issues are among working class people. So my main focus in Rednecks, Queers, and Country Music was on sexuality in relation to the white working class. I grew up as a queer kid among working class people in a rural part of Ohio. I certainly encountered homophobia, but it was no worse than I would encounter in the middle class. And in fact, that was the homophobia that really scared me as I moved off into middle class worlds by going to college. You know, I use a vulgar David Allan Coe underground song, F. Anita Bryant, as my main example in relation to that. But middle-class people to this day can't hear that song and hear its actual message right. They think it's a homophobic song because he's saying, F. Anita Bryant, who the hell are you, telling all them faggots that they can't be free? He had been in prison. He had had sex with men in prison. He knew what he was singing about, and it was an anti-homophobic song. It was a progressive song. So part of the problem is, at this point, especially, we have such class segregation. The classes know each other so little, so poorly, that middle-class listener doesn't know a pro-queer country song if it bites them in the butt. They think they're hearing homophobic songs because it's a country song and this guy has a little bit of a twang and he's talking about queer subjects, queer issues. So, you know, we're really bad off. And I don't trust Tom Frank or many other members of the narrating class to tell me anything reliable about cultural issues among white working class people or working class people of color, for that matter. One more little data point is that, in fact, the folks whose incomes were above $100,000, they're the only ones who voted in majority numbers for Trump. Everyone below them voted in majority numbers for Biden. 54% of those folks with incomes over $100,000 voted for Trump. So who is Trump's base? I'm not saying that no working class people were voting for Trump, but even according to the stats, we have just the reverse in the 2020 election. 54 for Trump to 42 only if you're above $100,000. Just below that, 42 for Trump to 57 for Biden.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Dean Hubbs, a historian, musicologist, cultural critic. She teaches at the University of Michigan, teaches about inequality and the progressive currents in working class movements. We've discussed some of the progressive currents. Let's talk about some of the other progressive currents in working class music. Dean Hubbs. To what extent does the growing inequality and precariousness enter into the songs that are listened to and popular?
Yes, I think if you have the right ears and if you're accustomed to country music, you will hear those themes coming into country songs. Country takes up its themes often from an angle, kind of obliquely. There's a kind of stereotype of country songs as being very sad. So I think the real peak of sad songs was in the honky-tonk era. But then there are also a lot of country songs that are about hard times, and they juggle the difficulty of the subject matter with letting you cry in your beer and really get up in your feelings without depressing you. So there's this kind of juggling act going on. There's a lot of kind of positivity in country music. Popular music critics in the Trump years have been writing at times about all the themes of unity in country songs and all the positivity in country songs. And I agree with that. Country songs are different from folk music, for example, that is really quite pointed about its politics at times. You and I were talking about the radicalism of a song like 9 to 5, but even that, you know, you think of the jaunty, bouncy 1980s pop country crossover vibe and groove of Dolly Parton's 9 to 5. It is a radical song in terms of its labor versus management position. And yet, if you are a casual listener, you don't actually have to hear that. And you may just love tapping your foot or shaking your booty and not have to face up to a more political message than you care to do. So I think that country songs leave that kind of space very often. I think there are lots of country songs that are very much about, I got to be out in the country. Don't put me in the city. I won't last a day. And then you get laundry lists of what is so beautiful out here in the country. And those are environmental themes. But again, you don't need to think of a song like that in a political frame if you don't want to.
Dean Hubbs, we've talked about how country music is becoming increasingly progressive, and more people are now supporting Medicare for All. Florida just voted for Trump, but it also voted by a huge margin, 15-20%, to raise the minimum wage in Florida to $15 an hour. There's tremendous amount of progressive sort of sentiment. There's been real advances, it seems to me, especially in working class life. Your sense of how all of those sentiments can inform real political action and build movements.
I agree with you. Society has become more progressive. It has become more progressive in the realm of acceptance of LGBTQ people. More people in the surveys show more progressive anti-racist views. And it is across classes, whether the narrating class knows that or not. And you see it in country songs. Carrie Underwood had a hit in 2018 in the Trump years called Love Wins. That in itself was a queer slogan, right? Referring to the advent of same-sex marriage. There are other songs that you and I talked about, and I hope you're going to be playing Eric Church's duet with Rhiannon Giddens from 2016, a number 9 country hit called Kill a Word. I think that these songs were all commentaries on the Trump era, on the division and the hate. A lot of folks would have heard Tim McGraw's number 1 hit from 2016 called Humble and Kind. I always heard that song as a commentary on what kinds of human values are worth pursuing and leaving hate behind. Even Luke Bryan's 2018 top 5 hit, I Believe Most People Are Good, is another one. It has the progressive line that pops up in various country songs, Love Who You Love, which is heard by country listeners as a pro-LGBTQ line. So about what we might do from here, first of all, we have ignored economically for 45 years the plight of working class people, whether they be white or black, indigenous, or people of color. Working class people have really gotten the shaft over the last 45 years. But I have this idea that keeps coming up in my mind, a book project that I might like to do. It would be a history of working class progressivism. And the point would be to educate, first of all, middle class and upper class people about the advances that we owe to the working class, and also to educate working class folk themselves, who so rarely can find any positive stories about themselves in our media landscape or in textbooks at school or anywhere. If we have positive stories about the working class, it's always the heroes of the working class past, the contemporary working class, the working class people we actually live with know. So I already have one chapter that could go into this book. It's in an article that I published a couple of years ago. I wrote this right after the Trump inauguration, and it's called Country Music in Dangerous Times. And I take a handful of songs. These songs happen to be from the 70s and 80s, but songs that were really progressive, including the beautiful Merle Haggard song. Out of the hundreds and hundreds of songs he wrote, he always claimed it was his favorite, and it never became a famous hit. The record companies were far too conservative, didn't even want to release it. But it's called Irma Jackson. It's about forbidden interracial love. Just after the Trump inauguration, in this paper, Country Music in Dangerous Times, I started thinking that maybe when Merle Haggard wrote that song in 1967, it's very likely he might have written it in relation to Mildred and Richard Loving, the biracial couple, a white man and a black woman from Virginia, who had been ripped out of their beds in 1958 by the cops because they had dared to fall in love and get married and have a family together. And they fought it all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they were the working class heroes who gave us interracial marriage. I realized that even though there was a feature film that came out that year about this couple, the Lovings, the case, of course, was Loving v. Virginia, but they had never been celebrated specifically as working class American heroes, and they need to be. That's the powerful thing that could be perhaps transformative. What if we start identifying progressive heroes as working class when they've been working class folks? We have such an underdeveloped vocabulary of class in the United States, except for all the shadowy code language by which we point fingers at the working class, in the same way that we celebrate if a certain contribution came from a woman or a BIPOC person. We need to start celebrating progressive contributions that came from working class people.
Dean Hobbs, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Such a pleasure, and thank you for the work you do, Bill. I look forward to next time.
Yeah, I knock out temptation's teeth. I sever evil and let it bleed. Light up wicked, stand and watch it burn.
This is KBOO Portland. You're tuned into the Old Mole Variety Hour. The song was Kill a Word by Eric Church and Rhiannon Gibbons. In the wake of National Homeless Persons Memorial Day, Desiree Helliger now speaks with Catalin Day and Benjamin Donlin from the Western Regional Advocacy Project, RAP, about the impact of sweets on people struggling to survive on the streets, followed by Chelsea Ratzlaff talking with Raven Drake of Street Roots about C3PO, or creating conscious communities with people outside, about mutual aid, community care, and combating misinformation about the COVID-19 and houselessness.
Speaking today with Catalin Day and Benjamin K. Donlin, who are both volunteers with the Western Regional Advocacy Project and the Stop the Sweeps campaign, talking Monday the 21st, which is National Homeless Persons Memorial Day. And we just, I think the stats were just released that 113 people died this year, which was a 23% increase over last year. Sounds like houselessness itself is growing exponentially.
It's also just the beginning.
Definitely be more, especially when the eviction moratorium is up.
Tell us a little bit about the organizing work that you've been doing around the sweeps.
Stop the Sweeps is a coalition of homeless-led groups and supporters in Portland. Been around for about a year now. Our first demand was for a moratorium on sweeps, and things have definitely changed a lot ever since COVID hit. And we've kind of divided into different working groups, working on policy, doing mutual aid.
So I'm remembering last year that Debbie Ann Beaver was swept, essentially. She had died shortly before the sweeps came through.
I think the impact is immense when people have their survival gear taken away, their medication, their identification, things that keep them warm, healthy, puts them in a very precarious position. With the pandemic happening, it also puts them exposed to the virus. It's a very life-defining sort of thing to do to somebody, to relocate them, dislodge them, and to throw their stuff away.
Yeah, and a lot of times that stuff includes ID that they need for, you know, essential survival services, and it also oftentimes includes medications like, remarkably, insulin, high blood pressure medications, medications for people who are already pretty medically fragile.
Especially when it comes to things like syringes, right? When you have diabetes, those things are immediately thrown away because of the suspicion that it might be drug-related, right? And then heart disease medications get thrown away. The success rate for retrieving property is very low. I've only heard two success stories out of the hundreds of people I've talked to.
In an article from Portland Mercury last year, when they interviewed the Homelessness and Urban Camping Impact Reduction Program, which is the entity that does sweeps in Portland, they admitted that the majority of the things they collect from sweeps, they end up throwing out anyways because people don't come back to claim them. And there's a lot of reasons for that. I mean, I think the main reason is just that it's not super accessible to be able to get there and retrieve your stuff.
Right. And then once you're there, you have to basically provide proof of who you are and that it's your stuff. But that's kind of hard to do when all the proof is inside your stuff.
Is it fair to say, too, that when you experience a loss of on that level, people have trauma behind it? A lot of times it's the psych meds that have been taken, right?
Yeah, I think it's a really big understatement to say that sleep deprivation has a profound and large impact on being houseless and what it does to your mental state, your emotional state, every minute of every day.
I mean, we know it's been used as a torture tactic, and we know it is going to significantly impair people's ability to problem solve. Fair to say that it's not getting them any closer to any place where they can live inside, right? So what is the function of those street sweeps?
I believe a lot of it has to do with real estate speculation. And the way you get real estate value to go up is by improving your walkability score, improving your livability score. That's one aspect of it. And I think that has a lot to do with how neighborhood associations approach it. But there is another aspect where businesses are impacted. It comes from this 1980s model of looking at Midtown and the economic stimulus of downtowns has to be a certain aesthetic, a certain sort of way. The marketing and the cleanliness and livability of everything has to be just right in order to have the best sort of economic impact. And the way that they approach that is by hiring private security and sweeping out other houseless people.
I mean, is it fair to say that the kinds of complaints that get made about why sites have to be swept could easily have been addressed by simply providing porta potties and other kinds of sanitation and garbage pickup in the way that you would for housed people, right?
Yeah. But additionally, I remember, Metro put out a study saying that most of the outdoor trash actually comes from housed people and that they often just dump their trash at houseless camps because they feel like they can just get away with that. But yeah, you're right. Housing is the number one solution for homelessness, and additionally, the number one solution for a great deal of the medical issues, whether physical or mental, that are exhibited within the houseless population. It's always going to be housing. It's never going to be direct services as much as a house.
And we know that the housing and urban development budget was slashed, pretty draconian cuts in about 1978, 1979 through 1983, right? And it's just never been restored.
Yeah, they slashed it by a good 80%. Thanks, Reagan, Reaganomics. But there's been a lot of things that have happened since then as well, such as the rise of business improvement districts and how they have basically pushed onto cities to criminalize homelessness and to make it a crime to sleep in public, to be in public in just about every major city. And so the rhetoric has definitely changed and shifted, but the methods of removing people have not.
It seems fair to say that this whole situation is something of a setup. You withhold sanitation, you withhold garbage pickup, and then you use that as a pretext to continually punish people and move them along so that problem is not in your own backyard.
This is really just the inability of Portland and other municipalities of dealing with their own problem of gentrification and racist classes behavior. They're just unwilling to address it.
Portland Police takes up the most of the city budget out of any other department. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of units considered specialty units within the Portland Police Bureau. Mm-hmm. And they do have several units that are specifically focused on homelessness, which is something that we definitely advocate against, because it's a way to justify increasing the police budget.
If every time we see a sweep, we also think about that in terms of tax dollars used to basically move along people who are often, you know, really quite literally on their last legs. And I just want to remind people of, you know, Debbie Ann Beaver. They'd gone through, they'd swept, they'd taken her medications, including, you know, medications that she needed to survive. And then a couple weeks later, they swept through again and they discovered that she had died in her tent, which, you know, you could argue was a foregone conclusion of having taken her medication. How can people support the campaign?
If you want to get involved, we definitely encourage people to email us, stopthesweepspdx@gmail.com. And we can definitely get people into different working groups. In general, we also just tell people to pay attention to what city council has been doing, see what's up on the agenda. For instance, Rapid Response, which is a company that the city contracts with to do sweeps, their contract was extended for 1 year in 2019, January. So that means that their contract is most likely up for renewal again. So that's something to pay attention to and ideally advocate against when that's up for renewal, as well as just in general, consistently reminding city council that we don't want sweeps and to stop the sweeps.
Do you know what the annual cost of the rapid response contract is?
It's $4.5 million.
Okay, so we're saying that basically we could take that $4.5 million that's directed toward rapid response and all of that funding could instead go into direct services for houseless people or to housing development.
Yeah, if we look at the success of the C3PO camps and the way they've been able to house nearly 180 people over the pandemic at a fraction of that cost, they have a profound impact if we really invested into those sorts of models.
Guests today have been Caitlin Day and Benjamin Donlin. They're volunteers with the Western Regional Advocacy Project. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Desiree.
Yeah, thank you.
Next up, Chelsea Ratzlaff is going to be speaking with Raven Drake of Street Roots about C3PO, mutual aid, and community care.
So I am speaking today with Raven Drake, who is the Ambassador Program Manager at Street Roots. Raven is also the former Medical Program Coordinator of the C3PO Coalition. Hi, Raven. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
So just to get started, what is the C3PO Coalition?
So the C3PO Coalition stems from a proposal that myself and the executive director of Street Roots, Kaya Sandro, on alternative camping. The city bought into it and joined them along with 48 other partner groups in this coalition, joined together to build these safe shelter camps for the most vulnerable to COVID that we had at the time. And we were able to house in three separate camps. Two of them are affinity camps, which means they are identified to one group. On the east side of the river, we have the LGBTQI camp. And across the street from it, we have the BIPOC camp. And then we have the largest of the three camps on Northwestern Gleason, which is the mixed population.
Can you tell me a little bit about how those groups were formed?
Well, the coalition had a healthy mixture of all three of those populations of people. And so when we came together, and it came quite abruptly, from the proposal being picked up to the first camp launching was only 16 days. Mm-hmm. So it came together quite quickly, and we all pitched in resources from our organization, know-how, knowledge of the street, knowledge of communities out here. And everybody came together to really build out these camps with one dream and desire of creating a safe shelter place and a model to use other places in the city. It became a large labor of love for a great many of us, myself and Victory, who is actually the service coordinator for Dignity Village. Victory LaFleur became the two full-time staff members of this camp. I headed the medical and communications programs, and she was the admin.
I'm hearing you say that you're really adhering to the communities that are already established on the street and then just coming behind them and supporting them.
Yeah, we had this application process that allowed all of them to apply, and we had a great many people who had existing street families who were accepted into the camp, and the vast majority, if not all, of the family moved in at one time together. They camp around each other. They still have that deep sense of community, of family, which was very important to us. We also changed it from a more shelter model to a village model, where allowed the campers to manage themselves. Very quickly in the process, the staff that had been cobbled together, volunteered together to run these, stepped aside and allowed the campers to create their own spokes council, make their own rules, and govern themselves. They now take care of their own admissions into the camps, rulings for administrative reasons on, you know, someone needs disciplinary or needs to be put out. And they're self-sufficient in managing themselves. And currently we're working with the camps. They actually just got winterized shelters that have heaters in them just a few weeks back. And we're now working with Pear and other area kitchens to build small kitchen setups there that people can use.
In the wake of protests that erupted after George Floyd's murder by police in May, C3PO was targeted in viral videos alleging that the camps were quote unquote Antifa breeding grounds where rioters were being housed. Raven, can you speak at all to these allegations and the impact they had on the camps?
I was actually there for most of it as it happened. The East Side camps, the LGBT and the BIPOC camp were the ones targeted. And very right-wing group posted on social media that these were training grounds for ASSA, which was completely inaccurate. This was just a home for people who hadn't known a home before. And so we were on high alert, and nothing really ever came of it. I mean, there were some people, a little bit of picketing kind of thing, but they never erupted to violence, which I was thankful for, that they didn't have to live through that. But there was a lot of fear in the camps when that was found online, that they were being targeted and that they would be attacked. And it was a great worry to the people who formed this coalition, who are still part of the coalition supporting these camps. You know, these people in these camps are not just some campers that we serve. These are our friends. These are family. These are people who are near and dear to us, that have become near and dear to us through this process that we've gotten to know. We actually ended up, just for their safety, emptying the camps and putting them up for over a week in a hotel to give them space out of there in case something were to happen. Thankfully, it never did, but that's really, I feel like that was one of the shining moments where it showed the difference between a shelter system and a, you know, independent village model, where we had the ability to inject more humanity into it and safeguard people, not just our property.
Right. And C3PO actually preceded the eruption of protests in May, right?
Yep. C3PO was established end of March, beginning of April, and the first camp actually launched on April 11th.
And can you speak a little bit to the primary medical issues that you're seeing on the streets?
So the biggest problem that we've had from the very beginning is a problem that's been around much longer than COVID, and it's the lack of, you know, showers and restroom facilities, sinks, and, you know, to combat this virus, you have to be able to stay clean. And that is a struggle out here on the streets. And so medical has been always one of our primary focuses here. So we've really focused on hygiene, on medical resources, bringing people masks, sanitizer, basic medical needs, water, food where we could. But we prioritized cleanliness, you know, COVID-related items to protect themselves, masks and hand sanitizer over all things. It became our mission to, as much as possible, to work our way through the city and be able to do for people and give them a fighting chance to do for themselves of staying healthy. I think it definitely led our group and many others who are doing outreach and on that same mission led to the reason why we haven't seen a huge population of houseless individuals who got COVID. I think that has really helped to keep the, you know, we armed them with information, what the virus really was, how it spread. We worked with them to understand why there should be social distancing. We've worked with houseless individuals on how to stay clean, how to take care of themselves, on arming them with numbers and resources to combat themselves if they get sick. And so it became our mission to just spread knowledge and resources wherever we could while the city was shut down.
Can you speak a little bit to, you know, the response?
At first, you know, there's a lot of misinformation on the streets. It's not like most of the people on the streets don't have internet access or a phone. And so news travels by word of mouth. And, you know, it's like the old game of telephone that we all learned to play as kids in kindergarten. By the time the story gets back to you, it's nothing to what you started it. Mm-hmm. And so the first order of business that we had, and probably what took the longest the first few months, was just simply combating the misinformation. And we printed tens of thousands of pamphlets giving correct information, distributed them freely through the streets as much as possible. We tried to educate people on what this virus really was, where did it come from, how it transferred itself from person to person, what surfaces it lived on, how long it lived there, the reasons we have to do these things. And so at first, the information we brought them was met with skepticism, as things are on the street. And slowly, people started to watch it with their own eyes and really read what we were bringing them and listen to what we were saying. And it took a little time, but we started to really make people understand the correct information. And at that point, we turned a corner where we were able to garner more help out of them in protecting themselves.
Right. And of course, the misinformation is a national problem. The work that you're doing in educating people on the streets is a good model, I think, for us on a wider scale as well.
The ultimate dream is that the ambassador program becomes not only houseless individuals on the street who can become a part of it, but that community partners, people in the community who've heard about this program, people who maybe have read about the program or heard from a friend about what we're doing, who get interested and want to get involved, to have the ability to come and volunteer and be an equal member of the ambassador corps and go out into the city seeking to improve communication and improve the quality of life citywide.
Is there anything else that you want people to know?
I think from the ambassador program, I would just leave one seed of knowledge with your listeners, and that is, it's never too early or too late to make a new friend. And the easiest way to change the life we live in and what people suffer through indifference is to take a few minutes of your time and simply sit down and say hello to somebody. You never know who you're going to meet on the streets. And just remember that the people on the streets are equally as scared of you. I've heard this a lot, where they see the rows of tents and they get scared for their safety. But I'm here to tell you, as somebody who started this year living on the streets and did all these things with the camp while still living on the streets before I got into housing, that we're equally as scared as the people who live in houses, because those were the people who called and supported sweeps. Those were the people who called the police on us. And so there is misinformation and fear across the board. And so I just ask people to follow their heart and, you know, maybe say hello to someone. You never know if you might be meeting your new best friend.
Great. Thank you so much for talking with me today, Raven. And thank you for all of the work you're doing.
And thank you for this time to talk to you. I very much enjoy it.
Well, I ain't got no home. I'm just rambling around. Just rambling worker. Go from town to town. police make it hard wherever I may go. I ain't got no home in this world anymore. My brothers and my sisters were stranded on this road. It's a huddled, dusty road that a million feet have trod. Rich man took our home and he drove us from our door. And I can't feel at home in this world anymore.
This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. The song was Bob Dylan's rendition of a Woody Guthrie classic, I Ain't Got No Home. Now concluding our program today, as well as concluding our programming for the year 2020, we end where it began with a commentary from the archive of our dear old friend and comrade, Clayton Margridge, who passed away in January. Written in October 2018 for the Old Mole, Unleashing the Erotic After Capitalism is perhaps the more relevant now than ever. Clayton discusses the way in which life in capitalist society limits our ability to take erotic pleasure in life, and how a life of freedom from wage labor would make all life, including work, pleasurable.
I see a different day or another day older, and that's all you can say for the life of the poor. It's a struggle, it's a war, and there's nothing that anyone's giving. What would they stand in about? What is it for? What did rest to be living? At the end of the day, you're another day colder. And the shirt on your back doesn't keep out the chill. And the righteous sorry past, they don't hear the little ones crying. And the plague is coming up fast, ready to kill. What a year it's a dying. At the end of the day, there's another day dawning. And the sun in the morning is ready to rise.
I argued last month on the Old Mole Variety Hour that a capitalist society is effectively governed by capital, driven by the implacable need for capital to grow. It must accumulate, bring more and more of the world into its clutches in the form of commodities, resources, human labor, and human desire for what it produces. Since that is its one and only interest, it has no concern for human or any other kind of life or for the conditions that sustain life. I said that those who work for capital, who manage pieces of capital in the endless game of investment, profit, and growth, have sold their souls to capital in a Faustian bargain for wealth and the power that wealth brings. Today, I'd like to expand on the fruits of this bargain and what it would mean to undo it. What happens to people who sell their souls to the devil, that is, to capital? They become instruments of capital, mere calculators of costs and benefits, sworn to manipulate people and resources in whatever ways will increase the return on investment. Regardless of any personal feelings they may have about damage done to people, animals, or the biosphere, as practicing capitalists, they must work to advance the interests of their share of capital, and that includes insisting that what they are doing is within their rights and is even good for the world. How then have they lost their souls when they do this? To have a soul is to inhabit a living, loving, feeling, sensing, thinking, and caring body. It means being sensitive and responsive to the world, especially to each other. Most people start out as children with souls in this sense and with the capacity to expand, fine-tune, and take increasing pleasure in what the earth provides and in their relationships with others. Art is one way we can enhance our awareness and love of the world. It is this open and ever-expanding sensitivity to and empathy with people's lives that is truncated by devoting oneself to capital. The masters and servants of capital often retain human feelings and sensitivity to friends and family and even to works of art. It is in their role as capitalists that they prune their souls down to pure economic calculation. It is not only the managers of capital, those who take on the goals of capital as their own, whose souls are truncated by capital. Capital strives to reduce all our desires to the desire for money, and money is provided to those who successfully compete with each other for the positions that capital makes available. That gives all of us reason to regard the interests of our fellow human beings as antagonistic to our own, limiting our empathy for them. Capitalists exacerbate this antagonism by emphasizing artificial differences like race and immigrant to prevent working people from uniting against them. Capital colonizes our souls by offering us substitute satisfactions, the pleasures of buying and having. Instead of enjoying our relations with the world and each other, we are led to imagine that the latest, biggest, and shiniest gadget will satisfy our desires and evoke the envy of our neighbors. So to the extent that our hopes and dreams revolve around exciting new possessions and the money to buy them, our souls have been taken over by capital. The desire to get and to have suffocates the pleasures of being and doing and loving. What this means is that the sensuous side of life, the erotic response to the world and to each other, is shackled by the requirements of life lived by the dictates of capital. The erotic is confined to the kind of sex modeled for us in the media, pornography, advertising, movies, and TV. So the rest of life, including our work, is what we must do regardless of our desires. The erotic, pared down to mere sex, is restricted to what little time we have after work, paying bills, childcare, and keeping house. Audre Lorde writes, "The principal horror of any system which defines the good in terms of profit rather than in terms of human need, or which defines human need to the exclusion of the psychic and emotional components of that need, the principal horror of such a system is that it robs our work of its erotic value, its erotic power and life appeal and fulfillment. Such a system reduces work to a travesty of necessities, a duty by which we earn bread or oblivion for ourselves and those we love." End of quote. Suppose for a moment that the dominion of our lives by capital is what has made work a painful necessity and reduced what we can enjoy to commodified sex and the buying and owning of commodities. If so, then imagine the result of being free from the necessity of wage labor and the competition for money. What if we were united in a common social project of democratically managing the human and natural resources for the well-being and enjoyment of everyone? What Lorde called the erotic value and power of our work, indeed of all life, could be restored to us. Herbert Marcuse's 1955 book, Eros and Civilization, makes the case for this possibility, drawing on and critiquing Freud. "Under non-repressive conditions," he writes, "sexuality tends to grow into eros, that is to say, towards self-sublimation in lasting and expanding relations, including work relations, which serve to intensify and enlarge instinctual satisfaction." End of quote. In other words, waiting for us over the horizon, beyond capitalism, lies a world in which our deepest desires will be fulfilled as we work together to create the world which fulfills those desires. Erotic experience is when we know for sure that what we are doing right now is what we most want to be doing right now. That can happen in good sex. It can happen when we are making or listening to music we really love, or in a great conversation among people we feel at home with. Imagine that that was the way we felt most of the time. I'm Clayton Morgeridge for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be starting anew.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patricia Kohlberg has produced today's program. Thanks to our contributors and guests, Bill Resnick and guest Dean Hubbs, Desiree Helligers and Chelsea Ratzliff, and their guests, Caitlin Day, Benjamin Donlin, and Raven Drake, and Denise Morris, and especially to our deceased comrade, Clayton Morbridge. Only 3 days until December 31st and year's end, which also marks the end of the KBOO's winter fundraiser. KBOO was selected to be part of this year's Give Guide by Willamette Week, and we have a goal of raising $50,000 by the end of the year. Show your support by going to kboo.fm/give. All donations will be matched up to $25,000. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the Mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. As Moles, we seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives that move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the Old Mole mission. And here's wishing us all a better new year than the one now passing. As always, you'll be able to find the podcast of the show in a day or two on our website at kboo.fm. We also invite you to like the Old Mole Variety Hour on Facebook and to follow us at Old Mole on Twitter. If you have suggestions, comments, or questions, you can reach us via our KBOO webpage or at Old Mole Variety Hour, all one word, at gmail.com. This is KBOO Portland.